I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to another special episode of Willy Willy Harry Stee, where I take a more general look at what was going on in the world whilst our monarchs were trying to keep hold of their crowns. And in this episode, we're going to look at what I've come to realise is an incredibly important and significant event in British history. Well, in world history, really, which is the Seven Years' War, which ran from 1754 to 1763, but was really part of a lot of other wars that were going on at the time. And I'm very pleased to have as my guest the historian and TV presenter Dan Snow, who has presented countless TV history programmes and has written many books. But I think his main interest is on 18th century strategy and war. And in 2010, Dan published Death or Victory, The Battle for Quebec and the Birth of Empire. Dan is the son of the TV journalist Peter Snow and is the great-great-grandson of Prime Minister David Lloyd George. He also set up and presents his own online history channel, History Hit. And he is also, so far, the only one of my guest historians who has danced on a Strictly Come Dancing Christmas special, which we'll get on to later. And I first met Dan at the Chalk Valley History Festival, where he's been a regular team captain on the history quiz I host there, Histrionics. So I'm very pleased to have you on as a guest, Dan. And just before we get into the Seven Years' War, can you just talk us through what History Hit is and how that works?
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I was thinking when he talked about that quiz, I'm not sure I've ever won. I think I'm like the opposite of Paul Merton on Just a Minute. The other team win every single time. Charlie, I'm starting to smell a little rat.
But you are always the person on who knows the answer to absolutely everything.
That's not true, but that also then is, you know, doesn't really match up with my inevitably losing streak. So basically, I was making history shows and sort of trying to write books and do the normal thing in the sort of early part of the 21st century. And I just had this overwhelming sense that the internet was a thing that was happening. Mm. And I don't claim to be super young anymore, but I definitely was young enough that we had the internet at university, Charlie. Before YouTube existed, we would share funny videos of people falling off ladders. You know, that was that was my generation. So, and I remember making these TV shows that would go out once to a great big British audience and then would just disappear into the BBC archive. And you'd get letters going, I'm really sorry I missed that programme, I'd love to see it. And you go, I hope they repeat it sometime. Mm. That was literally the answer you had to write in letters. Occasionally the BBC would release thing on VHS or DVD for the shop. And I remember thinking, this is a bit bonkers, isn't it? So really from the beginning of my career, I've been trying and throwing a lot of muck at a lot of walls and none of it, and virtually none of it stuck. I was trying to work out how, whether it's historians or communicators or anyone, can use the internet to publish content, which now seems the most ridiculously stupid thing to say, because that's what every single, it's what you're doing, it's what I'm doing, it's what people are doing in America as we speak, trying to get Trump re-elected. It's why we've seen the rebirth of authoritarianism around the world. You know, it is a much lamented great cultural shift of our time that people like you and me can just get on the internet and start broadcasting. And I was aware that there was a sort of space, I guess like you, I knew there were lots of history fans in the world because I went to history things and there were loads of people there. And yet it was written off as a bit of a weird, sort of siloed, geeky pastime. And I was like, I think it's much bigger than anyone thinks. Mm. I think people love history, and I think kids love history, and all these like young people don't like history. That does not tally with going into schools, with what they're reading, with brilliant Michael Morpurgo books, with the books that you work and, you know, celebrate. So I just got lucky really and got a bit ahead of the curve, so I started my own history channel. It's quite exciting, and it's, you know, the happy thing is it's truly international, more subscribers in America than in the UK. So it seems that it's something that's sort of it's something that's working. I'm very lucky.
When did that kick off then?
So that was about 2017, 2018, and we make one history documentary a week. Most of them you'll be glad to hear without me. So we have wonderful historians like Susanna Lipscomb and Ellie Yarnigan and lots of, you know, various people from around the world. And we had one with Tony Robinson last year on the Victorian Workhouse. So you've
created a huge amount of content there.
It boggles my mind given where we started.
And presumably it's all still there and available.
Well, that's the thing about Charlie, about the history content. It's, as they say, evergreen. It's not like doing a load of politics shows that kind of run out. So, you know, we every year on the anniversary, obviously the Christmas truce around Christmas time, we stick up a documentary made a few years ago and with some really wonderful testimony about the Christmas truce, and we shot at a wonderful World War One battlefield site where they filmed Downton Abbey and various other things. And that every year people are like, oh, that's great. So it's really fun that content, you can keep upping that content and people keep enjoying it. Like your podcast, people can discover it and then go back and listen to all the previous episodes. There's no time stamp. One hopes so, yeah.
And presumably you must have quite a few on the Hanoverians and the likes of the Seven Years' War.
Yeah, I think the long 18th century is, everybody can acknowledge, the best and most interesting and important piece of history. And it's the century that gives us, you know, the massive expansion of the European empires into the rest of the world, the eclipse of, you know, Mughal India, the Industrial Revolution changing the global balance of power, the ability of European powers to produce weapons of extraordinary accuracy, range and potency, the development of financial systems, of complex government administrations, and also then ideas, anti-slavery. The first time people start talking about women being given a vote. Peals of laughter as one radical MP stood up in the 18th century and suggested that in Parliament. But I mean, that was beginning to be a part of the dialogue. And of course, revolution, republicanism, you know, America, France, you get Enlightenment thinking. You know, this is a time of scientific, engineering, political sort of transformation, really. You know, steam engine of the early 18th century on this funny little island of ours. You know, that's what I find fascinating about it. Why Britain? Why did this little island of ours, which played no huge part in global history to that point, why did it all happen here? And why did Britain build a kind of international system, the largest empire the world's ever seen? It's an extraordinary story, and also with significant repercussions today for our climate crisis as well. But, you know, so it's a story about Britain, it's a story about the world, just fascinating stuff. So there's lots of beautiful stuff being produced. You know, there's an unbelievable explosion of wealth and into Britain. So you get paintings and stately homes and remarkable buildings. And so, yeah, so both for military, political and social and artistic history, the 18th century is a very, very rich time.
Well, that's what I'm realising as I'm making this series, which is why I'm making several of these side episodes around the Georgians. And this one, is to kind of focus on, well, to use the Seven Years' War as the sort of starting point, but to look at what was going on in Europe and around the world in these various wars. And many historians are now saying we should really see the Seven Years' War as the First World War.
Winston Churchill called it the first sort of global war, the First World War. I mean, I think actually the War of Spanish Succession has a good claim to that as well. I mean, basically, as you say, the long 18th century, which we basically call historians like to steal bits of other centuries to make them longer and more exciting. And there's a very neat 18th, long 18th century, which is 1689. So William and Mary invade England, the Glorious Revolution happens, and England is placed on a course of sort of quite aggressive Protestantism, the strengthening of a kind of constitutional system of government where the powers of the monarchy are curtailed, Parliament has an increasingly important role to play. And then William uses this as a springboard to launch a massive war against Louis XIV, who he sees as a kind of would-be European hegemon who risks becoming a new Charlemagne, kind of conquering most of Western Europe. And it ends, that period ends with 1815 and the Russians watering their horses in the Seine in Paris and Wellington bedding Napoleon's mistress in Paris. You know, this is the final catastrophic defeat of France. And that is a battle for Europe. It's a battle for the world, really, because Britain emerges from that kind of hegemonic right across the world with colonies on every continent. But it's also a conflict that, like the Cold War, drives unbelievable technological change. Just as the American military would go around buying up all the first microprocessors and sort of supporting the development of the tech industry and the development of the World Wide Web and all the things we know about, jet aviation, stuff like that, just as the Cold War proves to be an extraordinary accelerator of technology, so this period, you know, it's the British government placing massive orders for copper to sheathe the hulls of its ships in, to get access to coal, to so that gun foundries can found the cannon required. It is the government, you know, intervening, I think, in industry that plays a big part, not the whole part, but a big part in this explosion of the Industrial Revolution here in Britain. And that, as you all know, has got astonishing cascading consequences all over the world, because we go from Britain being the first country to industrialise. Technically, I think Wales is the first sort of region of the world where more people were working and living in cities than agricultural jobs. And now, of course, that's, you know, common throughout the world, and there's ginormous consequences that we're only still wrestling and beginning to understand coming from that. But so this is the long 8th century is a time of conflict. And as you say, Seven Years' War, one of the flashpoints. Really, there's a series of wars in the same way that people might look at the First and Second World War in decades' time, and they might go, actually, that's one conflict, right? A conflict caused by competitor nations, aspirant nations seeking to kind of break into an older imperial pattern. And in that case, Germany and latterly Japan. And actually, it's that should be seen as one war. Well, in the same way that people now talk about the Second Hundred Years' War, so starting with King William and his battles in coalition against Louis XIV, the first battle of that war, fascinatingly, is the Battle of Bantry Bay, 14 May 1689, off the coast of Ireland. I find it fascinating and wonderful. We can talk about a great global conflict, but where the actual flashpoints are so sort of random and extraordinary. So you get the Battle of Bantry Bay, a naval battle between the British and the French, the English at that time and the French. And then it ends with sort of Waterloo and the fall of Paris in 1815. And there are a series of wars which have the most extraordinary names, which I know you'll enjoy. But the Nine Years' War gets us underway. Boring. Not putting much effort into that. Then the War of Spanish Succession, which is always just absurd. It's actually a European war around who should be the King of Spain. The French and their adversaries both had candidates. And then we get various other wars, but Britain manages to slightly sidestep those in the Baltic region and stuff. But you get the War of Jenkins's Ear, which is everybody's favourite name.
And, well, the Fantastic War. I quite like that one too.
The Fantastic War. a contradiction in terms.
Yes.
And then the Seven Years' War. But I mean, the Seven Years' War, amusingly, has got, you know, a series of different names depending on what.
Well, also, yeah, and whether it kicked off 2 years earlier in America.
It didn't last 7 years. That's the pub. Yes. The great trick question about the Seven Years' War. Yeah.
What are we officially going for? Nine or?
I think I like about nine, but it's like the Hundred Years' War, of course, didn't last 100 years.
Yes.
7 years War didn't last 100. So it's known as the French Indian War in North America because it was against the French and what they would have referred to as the Indians in that period. In Europe, there's Frederick the Great goes on the rampage, astonishing wars in Europe, in which Frederick survives by the skin of his teeth.
Right. So just because my listeners won't necessarily know who all these people are, Frederick the Great is the guy ruling Prussia, this big area in sort of northeastern Europe, which emerges as a new powerful force at this time. This is the land of the Junkers, this militaristic noble warrior class. And I think, I mean, just as you have there, in this series, I've kind of lumped all these wars together, saying really they're all just part of this massive ongoing war in Europe, with countries trying to define their borders and influence.
In that we tend to fight our neighbours, yeah, yes. Exactly. And it's the old Thucydides, Athens and Sparta. You look across your shoulder and you don't like the look of your neighbour gaining in power and strength, and you try to strike them before they become unassailable. That's the, you know, one of your basic motifs of, sadly, of global history. And in fact, I was reading the other day about this wonderful World War I and World War II general, Sir Adrian Carton de Wyatt, and he had it even simpler. He just goes, because they're neighbours, they were often at war. It's just like, and I think he's right, you know, sort of international relations people can dress these things up. But, you know, Austria and Prussia were locked in a vicious struggle, just as France and Britain were in this period, and Russia also getting involved, and then also British and French and others fighting over the, sadly, corpse of the Mughal Empire in India.
Yes, I think people forget that the British started out in India basically fighting the French over, well, who was going to steal the Indians' massive wealth.
Various different wars going on, but you're right. Then we go 7 years. Well, after that, you get the American Revolutionary War, the French Revolutionary Wars, and the Napoleonic Wars. So it is just a period of extraordinary conflict. And it's a period that really sort of defines Britishness. Britain comes into being during this Second Hundred Years' War, 1707, and partly in response to that war, partly in response to the pressures put on the English and Scottish state treasuries, you know, the demands of making war on this gigantic scale, fitting out these fleets and armies that are becoming ever more expensive as technology improves and the opportunities to wage, you know, complex, sophisticated industrial war kind of start to build up.
And this is the era when we start to get these heroes of the British Empire planting our flags around the world. Captain Cook discovering, in inverted commas, Australia and New Zealand, and military heroes like Nelson and, I don't know, the Marquess of Granby. Now often considered a bit of embarrassment for what they represent, and in many cases forgotten.
I think a generation before us, Charlie, people knew about this period a lot more, because
yes,
this was the period where our granddads and dads, in their brutalised sort of education, which was preparing them to go out and man a distant imperial frontier, this was the period, you know, Clive in India, Wolfe in Quebec, the Black Hole of Calcutta, these were things that were, you know, and Nelson, although Nelson's endured a little bit more, but these were things that everyone knew about,
yes,
100 years ago.
Yeah, no, that's really clear that, you know, that I remember all these things from being a schoolboy in the 1960s, where you were still taught that whole imperialistic thing and the great heroes of the empire. But my three boys won't have heard of any of these people, really.
No.
They'll know Nelson and
Wellington. I blame the parenting on that one. But no, that, you know, that we pick the stories from the past that means something to us in the present. I mean, we've always done that. And to a previous generation, it was useful and important for them to know about the people that forged this empire that they found themselves ruling over. But now that's less useful for us. As a society, we're kind of more interested in social reformers. And of course, scientists and engineers, quite rightly. I mean, we're living in a time of extraordinary change. We want to know about Brunel and Telford, probably more than Clive and Wolfe. And actually, even though I'm more interested personally in the latter, I don't mind that. I get that.
Well, I mean, some of these guys, though, are sort of being dragged back in the limelight as examples of how terrible the British Empire is and all the things we've done wrong. And you know, to reassess them not as heroes, but they are now representative villains. I mean, particularly villains, someone like Clive.
Yeah. And you'd have to say, at the risk of being a woke warrior, I mean, you have to say Clive was a pretty nasty piece of work. But in that sense, extraordinary. I mean, and it just goes to India as a sort of a minor official, penniless, ends up commanding armies, bribing Mughal officials, playing the Game of Thrones, capturing Bengal. I mean, it's, you know, extraordinary, extraordinary career.
And amassing vast wealth on the back of it.
Amassing a stunning amount of wealth that he and his peers, the so-called nabobs, come back from India, these nouveau riches. They sort of, there was a fear that they were sort of threatened to upend the social system in Britain because these low-born men now could wield astonishing wealth. As it turned out, lots of these low-born men with astonishing wealth were beguiled by the existing elite into kind of buying stately homes and taking up peerages and intermarrying with their daughters. So they were sort of bought off, as the British elite has always proved very adept at doing, I think. It's sort of absorbing new sources of money and influence. But Clive cut his own throat. You know, he died by his own hand. His career is not just troubling to modern revisionists, but himself. I mean, he went through and experienced is obviously extraordinary.
Well, I mean, also on that front, I mean, I don't know where you stand on the theory that General Wolfe basically deliberately got himself killed.
Yeah, I think there's... I think British officers at the time, there's a great expression, there's a couple of great expressions about this. One is that, I think it was Wolseley in the 19th century field marshal, he said, the surest way to get ahead in the British Army is to try and get yourself killed at every opportunity. and it's certainly, you know, so Nelson, one of the most dangerous jobs on board a Georgian naval vessel was being the captain, because you stood on the quarterdeck, immobile, without any cover, in a uniform, roaring commands at people. And the enemy are, you know, their muzzles, their guns are touching yours. I mean, they're meters away. And you are looked down upon by everyone up at the rigging of an enemy ship and people on the poop deck. So the captain casualty figures are pretty terrifying in the Georgian Navy. Nelson was obviously admiral. He was obviously mortally wounded, killed at the Battle of Trafalgar. There were others killed there as well, commanding ships. Wolfe showed himself conspicuously to the enemy. But King William at the Battle of Boyne takes a cannonball, glances off his shoulder. Wellington's almost killed at the Battle of Assaye. Blücher was ridden over by his own cavalry in the Battle of Ligny. Frederick the Great was always exposed to personal risk. I don't think that it's super unusual. I do think in the case of Wolfe, who's this general we might come to in the Seven Years' War, a young general, promoted quite rapidly, very odd guy. Obviously didn't get on terrifically with his mates. He's the kind of guy who does get promoted in war. In peacetime, the kind of clubbable, chummy peacetime army, he wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes or anything. But because there's plenty of opportunity for violence, he's quite good at war. He's very well organised. He reads a lot. He's very studious. So he's just a good officer. And he performs well at Siege of Louisbourg, at capture of a big French fort on the Atlantic coast of what is now Canada. And he is promoted as quite a young commander into this expedition to go and capture Quebec, the capital of the big French Empire in North America. And he falls out amazing with his brigadiers. These three brigadiers think he's an absolute idiot. And I think when I wrote my book, if I'd been sort of braver and older, I'd have tried to write a sort of dangerously exciting book about how actually Wolfe deserves no credit for this at all. It was all these three brigadiers and the unsung hero, the Admiral Saunders. Wolfe got violently ill, dysentery, as so many of the besieging armies often did, because they're all pooing and peeing in their own water supply. They've got no idea what's going on, and the supplies are limited. And so Wolfe, on his deathbed, really, his senior officers and this admiral get together and I think come up essentially with the plan that wins. But I probably could have made more of that and put a sort of much punchier introduction in there. You learn these lessons, don't you? Anyway, he then recovers sufficiently to lead this final expedition, sort of in person, and climbs the Heights of Abraham, marches out onto this battlefield, takes the French by surprise. They sortie out of Quebec, launch a kind of suicidal attack on the British lines, and are badly defeated. And Montcalm, the French commander, is mortally wounded, and Wolfe is killed on that battlefield. So both commanders killed. And it is true that Wolfe does the best thing he could possibly have done, is get killed, because there was going to be one of those wonderful post-action fallouts, when everyone blames each other. See the Conservative Party after the next election for more details here in the UK. And they were all going to kind of absolutely start briefing against each other and chopping each other's nuts off and trying to have inquiries. But of course, Wolfe was dead. So they all said, and there are letters where they say to each other, let's let sleeping dogs lie. And Wolfe was turned into a saint. He was canonized, a secular imperial saint. He becomes one of the founding fathers of empires. Benjamin West paints a picture of him dying, completely fanciful, absolute nonsensical fantasy picture of Wolfe dying on the field of Quebec, and it becomes the most reproduced image of the 18th century.
He's sort of lying in a sort of Christ-like pose, isn't it?
Christ-like pose with Native Americans, his officers around him weeping. In fact, half of them are on record of having hated him. Native Americans, the quote-unquote noble savages, kind of looking down wisely on, and actually Wolfe despised Indigenous Americans and refused to use them in his campaigns. So great sort of bit of propaganda, but he is immortalized like Nelson, possibly, I don't know, like Princess Diana. I mean, sometimes dying young in your pomp at the great moment of triumph is best for your reputation.
Well, before you fuck everything up.
Exactly, and become kind of old like us and grey and a bit boring, and you die when you're handsome and dashing, although I'm not sure Wolfe was ever particularly handsome and dashing, but he was.
No, some of the paintings, he looks quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
The more realistic paintings.
Yeah.
Right, but now, so we've sort of jumped ahead a bit there. Let's go back to the beginning.
I apologise.
No, not at all. I mean, this is all great stuff. So let's get back to the start of the Seven Years' War. you got King William coming over from Holland. Now, obviously, there was a strong impetus from him to kind of defend Holland from French expansion. But do you think it was inevitable, even if we hadn't invited William over, that we would have got drawn into this conflict? Can you talk us through the sort of various power blocks in Europe at the time?
Well, you've got a very powerful Catholic France. I mean, France had a pretty terrible 17th century, but it, like Britain, I mean, let's first of all say that England, Scotland and Ireland had been an absolute basket case in the 17th century. The 17th century hadn't been easy anyway. We now think it's actually to do with global cooling. There was a great spasm of instability right across all of recorded history. And we think perhaps as many as one quarter of humans died in the 17th century. So you get appalling wars, 30 years war, instability, the bloodiest war per capita in British and Irish history, which is the, what we sort of call the Civil War. And Britain was known as the land of revolutions. I mean, it was a basket case. France starts to emerge from that period, very powerful, new, young, dynamic king, Louis XIV. And he has enormous ambitions. He sees France out of a period of civil conflict and starts to conquer lots of bits of what we now know today as France, but had been sort of German lands. So on the Rhineland, places like Alsace-Lorraine, those kind of places you'll have heard of. He expands France to the north and east. He moves into what is now Belgium. And he basically just builds France up. Now, you know, again, like I said about Thucydides earlier, there's just a basic impulsion in global affairs, which is when your neighbour gets powerful and scary, you're quite tempted to do something about that. Now, interestingly, the Stuart kings of England, Charles II and James II, his little brother, were quite fond of France. In fact, they tried to model themselves. I think they'd have liked to follow that route of enlightened despotism. They thought God had put them on the throne. They liked fancy buildings and magnificent sort of protocol at court. And they looked to Louis XIV as a bit of a thought leader.
And they'd also both spent time at the French court.
They had a very good point. They'd spent time there. They, unsurprisingly, were not fond of kind of non-conformist, proto-democratic, squabbling Protestant sort of artisanal class folk, right? Because those are the men who'd chopped their dad's head off, right, and formed a republic. They had a natural affinity for a more divine right monarchy, kind of aristocratic French style of rule, and they indeed took a pension, a secret pension. They were being paid by the French. So they were kind of reasonably pro-French, but the problem with that is that the British people who were Protestant were worried about. They worried about this, they worried about Catholicism, they worried about absolutism. They were attached to a system of government where power was sort of spread around a little bit and Parliament had an important role to play. And that was something that Louis XIV had no interest in, and clearly Charles II and James II sort of followed in those footsteps. So William comes over and he makes a lot of the fact he was invited. A note was found by some people inviting him. But effectively, he brings a big army, lands in Devon, and he arrives saying he's here to protect the liberties of Protestant British people, because James II actually is Catholic. James II, by this stage, has become a Catholic, and he faithfully has had a son who is Catholic. So he has done that thing that monarchies must do. He has ensured the succession. And the birth of that son, in a way, was the death of that branch of the Stuarts. And so William comes over. James II is William's uncle, godfather, and father-in-law, I think. So this is a family squabble. And James II, William lands, and they don't, interestingly, this is the great what-if of British history, a bit like Henry II landing, take on Stephen. There isn't a climactic battle. There should be. It's kind of annoying at this point, because this is a big moment. James II takes his impressive professional army to Salisbury Plain, and then seems to have a gigantic meltdown, a very personal crisis. Now, James II is a young man, very talented naval commander, in particular very brave, no question about his martial prowess. But here, he reigns very, very heavily, and his army kind of disintegrates.
Well, I guess he did have quite high-profile defections as well. Like John Churchill, the future Duke of Marlborough, I mean, he took away almost half the army. But it sounds like you're disappointed that there wasn't another big battle for you to write about.
An extraordinary moment, really. And so Britain is spared another civil war.
Yes, and I'm sure, though, that if you were an ordinary English peasant, you'd have been quite pleased.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So then James is judged to have abdicated and William is offered the throne with Mary.
And so England is then brought back into this Protestant anti-French coalition. The Dutch are there. There are German states there. And they then begin this gigantic war. And because England and France and Spain and various places have got these little colonies abroad, Dutch, the war in Europe is exported to the colonies. And that's the pattern you then see repeating through the rest of the 18th century. These wars that begin in Europe in traditional ways, as you say, because nations have always fought each other and they've marched abroad. Well, now their colonists go, oh, we've heard a message. The home, and that's why in North America this is known as King William's War, and then you get Queen Anne's War. These wars are not known by their kind of European names because that would be inappropriate. But they the colonists all go at each other. They take the great opportunity. They go, oh, you know, England and France are fighting. Let's see if I can go and nick some more of the frontier. Let's push our own agenda. Now the interesting thing about the Seven Years' War is the war actually basically starts in the colonies. So you reverse that, you get blowback. You've got this extraordinary picture of North America where you have this giant Spanish empire stretching from what is now New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, Texas, all the way down to Tierra del Fuego. It's an extraordinary empire. And then you get this massive French empire occupying most of what is now North America. So what we'd call Quebec and Labrador and Nova Scotia and Ontario, but then down through the Great Lakes and down basically the drainage of the Mississippi. So what people might want to call the Midwest. That's New France.
Yeah.
This lightly held. So it's not swarming with French settlers and forts, but there are little trading stations and Frenchmen there, but it's a very light touch. But it is technically, you know, it's French. By the way, of course, no one's checked this with the indigenous populations, but it is claimed by France. And then you've got England, which English, New England and the English colonies, which are these people will recognise this little strip of colonies, the down the eastern seaboard of America. Interestingly, very small. So a smallish strip of land, but highly populated. So that's full of settlers, that's full of farmers, that's full of towns and cities and the beginnings of factories and, you know, trading. So you've got this vast French empire, lightly peopled, and this very, very densely peopled strip of coast stretching from what is now sort of Maine and Massachusetts all the way down to Georgia, well, touching on Florida.
And so, that, I mean, already by this point, that population is in the millions.
Yes, desperate to burst out of this coastal strip, demographics, you know, destiny. And there's this mountain range, the Appalachians and the Alleghenies. And if you look at a map, to get into the drainage basin of the Midwest, to get to the Great Lakes, the Ohio River, the Mississippi River, you have to sort of cross these mountains, and then you're in the Midwest. And so you've got settlers and you've got prospectors and you've got traders and you've got troublemakers and you've got blokes selling alcohol to the Native Americans. They're all heading over these mountains and they're getting in trouble. And they're sort of prospecting for land and then they get scalped by the natives or the French go, what are you doing on this land? And eventually you get this crumbling frontier, which you get in Africa in the 19th century and you get in Asia. And you get sort of the press back in Britain go, oh, His Majesty's subjects humiliated and despoiled. You know, this honest trader went into the interior of America, which, by the way, we don't recognise the French claim to at all because they're French. You know, Virginia claimed all the territory on the Virginia latitude from Virginia to the Pacific, even though they had no right to claim that. They just did. So you know, some farmer would go across. Now he's, you know, trespassing, basically, both on Native American land and French claim land. Anyway, he starts chopping down trees and he gets massacred and his family get brutalised and there's all sorts of hideous crimes, sexual assault, awful awfulness, terrible. You know, it's not unlike what you get today in Israel, Palestine, Gaza. You get a situation of tit for tat, shocking, disgusting atrocities that then feed, and then you get an endless cycle. And so then the newspapers pick this up, and in Boston and in Philadelphia and then in London, and it's like the government can't possibly allow these Native Americans allied to the French to sort of scalp our people and despoil our women. And so you get this sort of slow dragging in. And people in Paris and London do not want to spend money on the imperial frontier in North America, because now we know, bloody hell, places full of oil and raw materials and you get rich and, you know, owning. But back then it's like, hang on, we're about to go and fight a war so these bloody farmers can go and enrich themselves on more virgin land in the American interior. You know, why are British taxpayers going to do that? And Voltaire famously writes off Canada. He says a few acres of ice and snow. And the only useful product that came out of Canada was, well, there was lots of fishing off the Grand Banks, Newfoundland. Then there's beaver fur hats, which was the very, everyone in Europe in the 18th century had a beaver fur hat. Seems crazy, but it was like this. What? But again, who's getting rich off that? Well, a few blokes trading out of Bristol and in France from Brest and Nantes and these ports on the coast. So the kind of taxpayer is supporting, this sounds familiar, doesn't it? The taxpayers are supporting these private enterprises. They're enraging the locals. They're getting into trouble. They're getting into fights. Their traders are ripping people off. They're drinking. They're committing sexual crimes against local women. They're then getting scalped and murdered and chopped to pieces. The French state are like, great, we're going to have to send a bloody regiment of troops to protect these sodding trappers. And, you know, so there's this kind of very interesting dynamic going on.
Right. So this is what the Americans called the French Indian War. And that went on for about 2 years. And then how did that develop into the Seven Years' War in Europe?
Oh, this is the joyful thing, which I will just quickly say, is that basically the French Indian War, this global, in fact, which then becomes the Seven Years' War, this one arguably the great first global conflict, truly global conflict, is started by a young Virginia militiaman. So he's been sent to the West by the Virginia government to say to the French, well, you're trespassing on our land and we have economic interests in this frontier. And the French have no interest in this anyway. And he's guided by some indigenous Americans, and it's not clear quite what happens. But this little party end up ambushing a French party of soldiers, and sort of people knocking about in French territory, ambushing them and sort of massacring them. And then the French and their indigenous allies turn around and defeat this little force. And this young man, this young Virginia militiaman, is forced to sign a sort of document saying, yeah, it's all my fault. Sorry, I attacked them unprovoked and I'm terribly sorry. And I'm going to go back to Virginia. And that young man was called George Washington. Mm. So America's first president, one of the towering figures of world history, founding father, the man without whom it's hard to see that Americans could have won their independence against the British, is basically responsible for starting the Seven Years' War. And because in response, the Virginians go, no, that's completely unacceptable. They send back another expedition and the British get involved. And there's a famous British defeat at the Monongahela River, where it's up there with Isandlwana in Afghanistan, for sort of catastrophic defeats by British redcoats at the hands of indigenous people, you know, ambush and using clever tactics and technology. And Britain finds itself basically fighting a colonial war against France in North America. Britain then does its classic of, without a declaration of war, it attacks a troop convoy of French people going to Canada. And that's so that Admiral Boscawen sails up to these French ships in the North Atlantic and says, hello there. And they go, are we at war? And he goes, oh, I'll just check. And then he fires a massive broadside into them. And so that's the start of the shooting war. But this is very conveniently for the British, this is the great stroke of luck, really, is this colonial war. And this is a pattern that you see throughout British history, is joined up to a European war in which the Austrians attack Frederick the Great, trying to get back territory that Frederick the Great has nicked from them. And so the British see, right, what we're going to do is we're going to fight the French in North America. What we don't want to do is fight them in Europe as well, because you can't afford to. The British, throughout their history, and you see this in First World War and Second World War, interestingly, but you know, they're ideally what the British do is use their powerful navy to move troops around the world and attack European colonies to enrich themselves and gain more power and global position, while someone else in Europe does the fighting. And in this war, that someone else turns out to be Frederick the Great. So they've absolutely smashed it. You've got one of the great military geniuses of history, who the British just pay tons of money to, and Frederick the Great holds down the Austrians and the French. beating them in battle after battle, and certainly grinding out enough victories to exhaust the French and the Austrians. So the French have got this great strategic conundrum, which they have as a result of their geography, which they've never satisfactorily sorted out, which is they cannot both be an Atlantic global power and a European power because it's too expensive. You can't maintain a fleet that can compete with the Royal Navy and expeditionary forces that can compete with the British Army all over the world, whilst also fighting massive continental warfare, fighting on the Rhine, in the Low Countries, in northern Germany, which, you know, 100,000 men, you know, giant armies marching about with great big, you know, artillery trains. And that's too expensive at this point of history for the French to kind of deal with. And that's why the darkest periods of British history are the periods of British history where Britain finds itself fighting alone. So 1940 to 41 and 1806 to 1812, when Britain is sort of sitting there going, oh, damn it, we've lost. We're doing fine in the rest of the world. The Navy's scouring the world's oceans and we've got all the colonies. But we haven't got anyone in Europe that can take on the main adversary in Europe, be it Napoleon or Hitler. And so that's what the France is sort of trapped, and it tries to do both. It does both badly. So it's desperately trying to send fleets out to North America to fight the Brits. But they get intercepted and they get crushed and they don't get enough troops to North America. And the war goes very badly for them in North America and in the Caribbean, in fact, and in West Africa. So it's just a catastrophe for France. And in Europe, they're also trying to take on bloody Frederick the Great, which is a total nightmare. You don't want to find yourself fighting him. And Frederick the Great's being propped up by British cash. And so there's an expression at the end of the war that Britain ends up with this enormous empire stretching across North America. And Britain, and it was said that, you know, the British Empire in North America was won on the fields of Germany, because it was, because the French are so battered, both in North America, they've got nothing to trade with at the diplomatic table at the end of the war. Traditionally, the French go, look, can we have those places in India back or those places in Canada back? Because we've got an iron grip on, you know, the Channel ports that you want. Bits of Belgium, bits of Hanover, where the king, of course, is king of Hanover, which is a problem. So you don't want the French invading, you know, capturing Hanover. So but Britain on this war, because Frederick the Great is running absolutely rampant across Europe and the British are running rampant out of Europe, it's the most successful war in British history. And 1759 is known as the Year of Victories. And it was said that the church bells of Britain are threadbare with the ringing of victory. Capital of Canada, Quebec, falls to Britain. The key sugar-producing islands of the Caribbean fall to British expeditionary forces. There are British successes in West Africa. There is a massive victory of a British-Prussian army in Europe. There are some British troops in Europe under Prussian command. And there's a massive forgotten victory called the Battle of Minden, which is one of the great decisive, you know, hugely important battles against the French in our history. I guess when you've got so many, you can't celebrate them all. That's the problem.
Yes, and I was going to say that there really aren't any great European battles whose names we still remember today from this war. I mean, previously we had, I suppose, the Battle of Blenheim in the War of the Spanish Succession. Later on, we obviously have the likes of the Battle of Waterloo in the Napoleonic Wars. But I personally couldn't name a single battle during the Seven Years' War. Is that partly because we largely left the Europeans to fight each other in Europe and we're sending our troops off into battle in the colonies, such as India, where a lot of fighting was going on? But actually, was that the army of the British East India Company fighting out there, or had the official British army joined in by this point?
Very good question. I think there are British redcoats present later on at the so-called Battle of Wandiwash. There are a series of wars in this part of India and Bengal, which go on almost constantly through this part of the 18th century. So the British do start sending actual redcoats to India in this period, and critically, the Royal Navy. So the Royal Navy is super important. The Royal Navy, we should think about them not just fighting big battles on the high seas. I visited a battlefield where the Royal Navy push up the one of the great rivers of Bengal, way inland, way, way, way inland, to smash the French position at Chandernagore. Now, if the French had won, Chandernagore would be more famous than Calcutta. But Calcutta exists, Kolkata now. Chandernagore is a small town. And Chandernagore was the French base in Bengal, and it was obliterated by the Royal Navy, one of the most bloody, you know, the Navy kind of anchor off this fort and just pound it from point-blank range, terrifying. And then there are other, you know, there are other battles in India that people, you know, as I say, people may have heard of.
Of course, yes, Quebec, that's the big one. Yes, I do remember that one.
The other thing that the Royal Navy does, obviously, is sort of the French at the end of this year of just disasters in India and everywhere else, they gamble everything on an invasion of Britain. This is always the French kind of Hail Mary. It's fascinating. You see this in 1744, 1745, 1804, 5. when the French think, you know, I can't deal with this anymore, we have just got to strike at the head of the serpent. We're going to invade this goddamn island. And it's and they try in 1759. It's this amazing attempt, but for reasons that are too fascinating but too lengthy to go into, you can't gather a French invasion force. You can't gather the ships and the men required in one port in northern France. They don't have an appropriate port like Portsmouth or Plymouth. Mm. So actually, the French Navy had to sail out of Brest and go and meet the invasion force, which was in southern Brittany elsewhere. The British are blockading them in Brest itself, a miracle of science and planning, that the British can stay at sea off an enemy port, sailing backwards and forward for weeks at a time. That's an astonishing achievement and testament to the Royal Navy's kind of scientific and logistical abilities. Mm. Anyway, they're blown off by a bit of a gale. The French fleet sail round to Quiberon Bay to pick up their invasion fleet, but the Brits follow them. And in November, in a rising gale, with the light falling, the British charge. They crowd sail on, as they say. They put more sails up, and they follow the French. They've given them a slip, but they've managed to catch them up. And they sail into Quiberon Bay, which is a reef-strewn nightmare, shoal-infested hellscape, improperly charted by the Royal Navy. But they sail in after the French and fight this kind of twilight battle against the French, an astonishing battle in which several French ships are destroyed, the French are utterly humiliated, all of their invasion plans completely ruined. And in my opinion, is a more important, interesting battle than the Battle of Trafalgar, which is that I love saying that and getting people all wound up.
Yeah, but we had a better villain in that one. It was a proper Bond supervillain in Napoleon. You need a good villain to remember things.
Yes, exactly. That is true. And you have a sort of classic. You have the great character of Nelson, but Admiral Hawke was the one at the Battle of Quiberon Bay, and there's a wonderful naval toast. I can't remember now. Very annoying, but it's a, you know, we'll fight with the courage of a Nelson and the eye of a hawk. Or something like that, and I love that. Anyway, so this is why Britain just got the bonfires burning every 5 minutes. There's just a revelry. I mean, if you ever want, you know, no one was getting work done late 1759 in Britain because there was public parties every time news dropped of another victory. And that's why HMS Victory is laid down in that year. Nelson's flagship at the Battle of Trafalgar, laid down in 1759 in the Medway, and probably called Victory because it was laid down in that wonderful year.
So that's the end of the Seven Years' War.
Kind of. I mean, Frederick the Great staggers over the finish line. He almost is completely destroyed. He's saved by a kind of deus ex machina that the Russian Tsar, the Empress dies and is followed by a sort of slightly educationally challenged successor who's obsessed with Frederick the Great. He's just a fanboy. There's no other way of putting it. He just loves Frederick the Great. He dresses up as him. He has toys. He plays toy soldiers. He kind of recreates his greatest battles. And he is eventually killed by his wife, Catherine the Great.
So that's Peter III, who some listeners might be familiar with from watching the TV comedy show The Great. I'm not sure they get around to his assassination in the series, though.
Before that, he withdraws Russian armies from this coalition that was threatening to completely destroy Prussia. And so Prussia lives to fight another day. So poor old Maria Theresa of Austria has fought this savage, brutal, unending war, almost coming so close to defeating her nemesis, Frederick the Great. But in the end, extraordinarily, sort of things after this shocking levels of violence and horror, things in Europe sort of vaguely return to status quo antebellum. You know, they kind of go back to where they were before, which seems extraordinary to us. But importantly, the French are kind of bankrupted. That's the key. Yeah. The French state is bankrupted. But also hungering for revenge, like absolutely desperate for revenge because they've been totally humiliated. At one stage, the British have captured an island off the coast of France. I think it's the Ile de Ré, I think it was, and just launch attacks from there. I mean, it's just impunity on the French coast. I mean, it's just intolerable embarrassment. And that means when the American colonies declare independence and start causing trouble, at 10 years, not long later, you know, the extraordinary thing is in the aftermath of this astonishing victory, the American colonists very cleverly go, hang on a minute, we've dealt with the French over the mountains in Canada. We've got no aggressors anymore. We've got no threat. Let's get rid of the Brits. We don't need them anymore. Who needs the Redcoats? Let's go it alone. And so they do, you know, only 10, 15 years later. The French then jump into that conflict thinking this is our chance to get revenge. And that just even more sends France even more into the red and makes kind of revolution pretty much inevitable. So all of these things have enormous consequences and all of them feed on to the next war.
Oh, I mean, I love the fact that the American War of Independence, that they were allied with France.
Yes, it's the most extraordinary thing, isn't it? I mean, it is the Machiavellian sort of contortions we can get ourselves into. So the Americans, having fought having raised a statue to King George III in New York, a great golden statue celebrating the salvation of the American colonies from the French tyrannical Catholic menace. 10-15 years later, they are cheers and welcoming French fleets into Rhode Island and Philadelphia and various places. And the French are the sort of saviours of the revolution. I mean, you could not make it up. But then, brilliantly, the Americans absolutely shaft the French by making peace with the British, which they agreed they wouldn't do. The French said, yeah, sure, but let's not make peace till we've both got our war aims, yeah? And the Americans are like, yeah, sure. Then as soon as the Americans kicked the British out, basically out the 13 colonies, the Brits said, fine, you can have your bloody 13 colonies, but we still want to go on kicking the French around the Caribbean, if that's all right with you. And the Americans are like, have at it, lads, have at it. So the poor old French, I mean, you really still feel sorry for the French. They got the Americans' independence. They got absolutely nothing to show for that war. And they, in fact, got badly defeated in the Caribbean by the Brits after the Americans had settled. And they utterly bankrupt themselves, and as I say, made revolution even more imminent. But so you almost do have to feel sorry for our poor neighbours there.
So, I mean, how strong is the parallel between the rise of Napoleon and the rise of Hitler, coming out of this sort of bankrupted nation, have been ruined by wars, everything's falling apart, and someone can see, all right, there's an opening here.
Yes, I think, I mean, as with any of these figures, isn't there? There's great luck and opportunism. I mean, there's so many points in Julius Caesar's career and Alexander's career and Napoleon's career and Hitler's career when it all could have got absent. You know, if a bullet had gone slight few inches to the left or right, if a judge had been a bit more proactive or whatever it might be. So, yes, out of great turmoil. I mean, this is the fascinating thing about history, isn't it? Out of great turmoil. It's like when you turn soil over, you get wildflowers, kind of beautiful wildflowers kind of springing out. You never knew were there. In every generation, there is a Cromwell, there is a Napoleon, there is a Hitler living amongst us. And instead, they're selling insurance. They're doing a podcast. They're doing whatever. They're a motivational speaker. They're a dashingly handsome 45-year-old with an online history channel who is otherwise a frustrated great global... No, okay. So they're sitting there. And 99.999% of them will never get that oxygen. The soil will never be turned over. But every so often, like, it happens. And there is a Napoleon amongst us today. But yes, and in 1930s Germany, the cataclysm of the Great Depression, all of the assurances of the old order, democracy, sort of liberal capitalist society, that will lead us to a better, brighter future, you know, rising living standards. These populists are saying, no, look, they lied to you. It's all nonsense. Only I can deliver that security. Only I can deliver that safety, food, security on our streets, lack of scary men marching around the streets calling for, you know, revolutions. And that's what Hitler does. It's what Napoleon does. It's what, you know, it's what strong men have always done. And, of course, they're all selling snake oil. It's all nonsense. But sometimes circumstances briefly make them look right. And it's the job of historians to point out that that's just contingency, and the answer to our problems is never a strutting, preening, self-important lunatic that says that only he can save us all.
Well, that is the perfect note to end on. That was brilliant, Dan. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
So that was Dan Snow, who I shall probably next be seeing at the Chalk Valley History Festival this summer, 2024. I would advise you, if you have an interest in history, to book your tickets now. It runs from the 24th to the 30th of June. It's a kind of alternative to Glastonbury. And if you want to learn a bit more about the Seven Years' War, get hold of Dan's book, Death or Victory, The Battle for Quebec and the Birth of Empire. And if you're hungry for even more history, you could do worse than check out History Hit. But for God's sake, keep listening to this podcast as well. Follow the podcast now to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Willy Willy Harry Stee was written and presented by me, Charlie Higson, with music by Tom Jenkins and production by Mark Jeeves. Willy Willy Harry Stee, the podcast, is the copyright of Charlie Higson, 2024.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.